Hello and welcome to EMS Research with Professor Bram, where we talk about the research-related issues that matter to those who work in emergency medical services. Today, we'll be talking about how EMS providers can protect themselves against legal prosecution. Welcome to the EMS Research Vlog and Podcast from the studio here in Houston, Texas. I'm your host, Bram Duffy. I'm a full-time paramedic on the street, like many of you. I also have an appointment as a research fellow with the Institute for Social Innovation at Fielding Graduate University, and I'm an assistant professor of communication at Kennesaw State University. I actually have a research study open now for first responders, so if you don't mind being interviewed by me, then go to my website and check it out, www.professorbram.com. It's ProfessorBRAM.com. You just click on the current research tab to apply. The other thing to share before we get started, I have written two different books on communication, and the most recent book was just released called Hypnotic Communication in Emergency Medical Settings for Life-Saving and Therapeutic Outcomes. You can find a link to the book below. Also, for sure, hang out to the end and I'll tell you more about it. I'm here today with John Ray Hassan, who's an attorney, registered nurse, and paramedic with a diverse background in leadership and operations. And presently, he serves as chief administrative officer and in-house counsel for Royal Ambulance and is a strategic advisor and counsel to Onward Health, and which is a health tech company. John Ray's career has spanned from emergency departments, helicopters, ambulances, and as an EMT, a flight nurse, to even national parks, and as a U.S. law enforcement park ranger paramedic. Prior to practicing law, he led a major 911 and interfacility ambulance transport operations and mobile integrated health teams and air medical operations across a pretty large distributed geography. He's a certified flight critical care and emergency nurse and a fellow of the Academy of Wilderness Medicine. He's admitted to practice in California State and Northern and Eastern District California Federal Courts. This guy is really something. I'm so happy to be able to bring him on and introduce. So, John Ray Hassan, welcome to the show. Tell me, is there anything about yourself that I missed? Anything else that you'd like to share?
Well, first up, Bram, thanks for having me on. I think that was a pretty comprehensive introduction. I've been one of those people who's been really fortunate to have had a blast of a career. Kind of divided into three segments, from really a patient care portion of my career early on to a leadership and operations portions of my career, and now really to a legal portion of my career.
Well, I found you because you had done three different articles in GEMS, and they were all sparked my interest because right now we have so much happening at the intersection of law and paramedicine. And so that's why I'm happy to be able to talk to you, not just about your articles, but about what's happening right now. And right now we have some death cases out, and these death cases are a result of a restraint or medication restraint. And it's a really crazy time right now because I don't know how to be more blunt about it, but I think paramedics are scared to have to sedate people now because it's not like just a matter of getting a wrong dose and a problem happen. You know, this is a murder charge, you know, that folks are getting for what they see as doing their normal job. And so this is the big topic that I want to look at, especially because there are two cases that I sent over to you in notes. Then the first one was the Earl Moore Jr. case. And this was the, I don't know when exactly it happened. I know Jim's covered it in February 2023, but it was a case where a paramedic and an EMT were charged with murder for improper restraint. And I saw those videos, and the videos were horrible. I don't know if you saw them, but my view of the, my view of the video was just that we have an out of control patient, and we have, you know, folks who are working to fix the situation. And for people who have not been paramedics themselves, they may not understand the importance behind taking control of those kinds of situations, because yourself, your partner, or that patient can get hurt. And, you know, I saw the female paramedic that seemed to be come across as cold and callous during that event. And what other folks may not understand is that she is a female who is in an authority position to handle this situation. And in that respect, it's not necessarily the time to be coddling or any kinds of things, because this person could really hurt someone or themselves. And so I kind of saw this from two perspectives, and I have a lot of time for you to talk, but the other one is obviously the Elijah McCain case. And that was the one that hit the nation first. And far as a lot of, a lot of concern. And so when it comes to these issues, please take the floor. Tell us, like, what is it going to be like to be a paramedic, and how do we take care of our patients legitimately, but at the same time, don't end up with murder charges just for doing what we're trying to, you know, do for doing our job?
Yeah. So, you know, tons of great questions that, you know, and just some fantastic points. And I think this stuff is on the mind of a lot of paramedics. You know, first off, I wouldn't be talking about legal topics if I didn't give a disclaimer. So I have to give a disclaimer that this is not legal advice, and I'm not creating any attorney-client relationship, and you should absolutely consult with a lawyer in your home state about your specific facts. And then lastly, that these are my views and my views alone, and don't represent the views necessarily of any other organization or person. So I want to get that out of the way. You know, as I said, I think you really bring up some interesting points where I think a lot of paramedics are looking at this now and going, oh my gosh, if I sedate somebody, I may get, you know, I may have problems. And if I don't sedate somebody, I may still have problems. You know, so what do I do? And I think the short answer is really twofold. It's be reasonable and be kind, because 9 times out of 10, problems arise when people are not reasonable and not kind. And probably the dirty secret is that if you are eminently reasonable but not kind, you're still going to be fine the majority of the time. And if you're kind but not reasonable, you're still probably going to be fine the majority of the time. But when you're both reasonable and kind, you're good the vast majority of the time. So really, be reasonable and be kind. Now, obviously, it's not that simple. And certainly, if it was that simple, these cases wouldn't have happened, and I wouldn't be here. But I really do want to try and distill it down to being reasonable. What would another paramedic with my similar background, training, and experience be doing in this situation? And be kind, and be kind, one, not because it's just the right thing to do as a human, but two, because kind people tend to get sued less. So be kind. And many times people seek legal remedies when they feel like they've been wrong. Whether or not they've actually been wronged, it's that feeling of, oh, if I feel like I've been wrong, that oftentimes drives people to pursue legal remedies. So be reasonable and be kind. But as I just said, it's not that simple. And I think you also have to be a good medic and be a competent medic, be a competent EMS provider. In both the Earl Moore case and the Elijah McClain case, we see patient care that was pretty far outside of the acceptable standard of care. And while really traditionally care that goes outside of the standard of care is treated as a civil matter, in both of these cases, these turned into criminal instances, albeit I think these are two very different cases, and I think they turned into criminal incidents for two very different reasons. But nevertheless, aside from the fact that I think there was a lack of reasonableness in both situations, I think there was frankly a lack of kindness in both situations as well. There was a lack of just patient care that was clinically appropriate. For example, I don't believe any of us were ever taught to restrain somebody face down with their hands behind their back. I don't believe that any of us were ever taught that it's okay to sedate somebody and then, you know, not have airway management equipment there at the bedside, not be prepared to immediately monitor that patient. So in some cases, while it was the lack of reasonableness and the lack of kindness to a degree, it was also the fact that the patient care just fell below the standard of care and wasn't good patient care. And then next to that, you know, obviously follow the rules, follow your protocols. Your protocols in some respects are there to protect you and are really an important tool. And then make sure that your documentation is solid. And I think that, the documentation piece, how you document an incident accurately and thoroughly, can really be some of the best protection. And if you document what's occurring and why, that can be used to support your clinical rationale. And sometimes it's less important to document what you did and more important to document the why that you did. The why that you did what you did.
So these cases are definitely here because of police body cam, right? I mean, that's why we know about them, and none of this would have ever been possible before that. I think it's good that we have a way to make sure that we're doing the right stuff. I just worry about the precedent this sets for everybody that comes after this, because me, as the average paramedic, now think to myself, well, I mean, I could get murder charges if I do my job wrong. And so, it could, whereas at one point it was just a missed dose, I could have lost my job or my license, but now, I could end up in prison. And so, I know that we're taking care of situations that are out of control, and we are supposed to be the ones that come in to, create a sense of control that at least that would help, help that person. But I think that there are some similarities in how EMS providers approach these situations that are similar to how police handle out of control situations. And it's sort of like these two teams are working together for the same goal, but it's like a frenzy that can end up occurring, right? Because you take the energy of the person that's spitting in your face and running crazy, and then you add that to the police force energy, and now the expectation falls on the EMS provider. And it's a lot of pressure as a paramedic to have, cops yelling at you saying that this is your problem, this is a medical issue, being in those tough spots. So, all that to say, I may not create an egregious error, but now that the precedent is set, then I have to definitely consider this. And, things like a wild out of control patient might have be able to be caught on body cam, but then the patient dies in the ambulance, with me later, and now I'm suspect for the same stuff that these folks were, and so you don't have even the whole story anymore. But I'm just rambling about being scared, and I know that you're saying that, we should do the right thing, we should be respectful, and unfortunately the folks that we interact with in these situations are not even in the right mind whatsoever enough to, be able to maybe receive the care that we want to give them. Like, we want to show love, concern, and empathy and those kinds of things, but they may not even be in the right state for any of that to matter. So
I get it. I spent a number of years where I spent my summers as a law enforcement park ranger and paramedic for the National Park Service, and then my winters back as an ER nurse and transport nurse. And as a commissioned law enforcement officer, I was also a paramedic, and I also carried ketamine. So I look at these instances and I go, my gosh, how would I have handled and how did I handle those situations where you have someone who may go from a suspect to being a patient or patient to being a suspect? And what I'll add on that is to law enforcement, that individual is a suspect, but to EMS, that person has to be a patient. And despite the fact that that person may not be in their right mind, that that person may be under the influence of substances, that that person may even be trying to attack us, our mentality still needs to be that that is a patient, and that is not a suspect. And you mentioned the optics. Optics matter, right? Optics certainly matter to a jury. Look at the Elijah McClain case. The jury saw that body cam footage, right? What did they see? A paramedic going to a patient. Dude, don't throw up on me. So that notion of just how we handle those situations and how we approach those situations, our job, while I know there's oftentimes a lot of friendliness between EMS and law enforcement, our job is not to be law enforcement. Our job is not even to make law enforcement's job easy. Certainly not to make it hard, but our job is to provide good quality patient care. Because at the end of the day, as we've seen, if something goes sideways and we're not doing our job, and that job results in patient harm, especially in those situations, to where our actions demonstrate a conscious disregard for a substantial and unjustifiable risk, or where our actions are so negligent, as to constitute a degree of extreme recklessness, that can substitute for intent, and we can find ourselves criminally charged. So while I think that's still a very small risk, and certainly you can't practice paramedicine, you can't go out in the field and be paranoid. I was at an ambulance and ran some calls last week just because, and you can't run calls, you can't run calls scared. But you also have to understand the risk, and the risks are real. And we expect in 2024, I think the public expects EMS providers, much like law enforcement officers, to be able to make split-second decisions. And sometimes you're making split-second decisions with imperfect information. And those split-second decisions made with imperfect information can potentially have serious consequences. And while the court of law has historically given law enforcement officers and EMS providers and healthcare providers a lot of latitude in recognizing just the unique dynamics of those situations, the court of public opinion does not. And in 2024, when everything is on video and everything is on body cam, and those calls are all going to be reviewed with literally perfect hindsight as 2020, it's a different situation to operate in. So I encourage folks to ask yourself, A, not just how does this look, but am I doing the right thing for the right reason?
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons why I, as a scholar, have been focused on how paramedics communicate, and that's what I write about,
Yeah.
that's what I talk about, and it's because we are not actually taught how to, what words to use in what situations, because we're
Absolutely.
more focused on figuring out what's wrong and then doing the interventions. And if we, the big change happened for me. I've been a paramedic 25 years, so I was running EMS calls back before they had cameras in people's homes that are just on all the time, or in your vehicle, or in the ambulance, or cell phones that are. So it's everywhere. And so, yes, it means that we have to protect ourselves. And one of the just the small issue of there was an ambulance parked in a handicapped spot, and they were there on a call, but they didn't happen to have their lights on. This is just a situation I know about. And the result was that there was someone that filmed that ambulance in a handicapped parking spot, made a big ruckus online about it, and then the cancel culture and all the crazy. Well, that crew happened to have been on a call. They just didn't have their lights on, you know what I mean? And so all these things, it doesn't matter what we do, we're under a microscope. And even if we're a private ambulance company instead of a public ambulance company. A lot of folks think that there's a something different about being a 911 provider that's a private provider compared to working for the city
Most of the
entity, and
public
there's
doesn't know the
they
difference.
don't. Yeah, so you are
Most of
it.
the public doesn't know the difference. And as I tell people all the time, and when someone calls 911, they're not asking specifically for you to show up by name. They're asking for medical help, and you're who they're getting. So I think many times people can put too much identity in their service or too much identity in their agencies, and probably not enough identity in the fact that at the end of the day, we're there to do good patient care. And doing good patient care is incredibly important. And in both of these cases, had they done good patient care, even with the same outcome, probably wouldn't be facing criminal charges today, right? Even with the same outcome. Had the patient care, been good, had the first thing they had done after administering ketamine been to properly get Mr. McClain on a gurney, get him on a
Secured airway.
monitor, start tracking his end tidal, and managing his airway, probably wouldn't be in the same situation today, right? But instead, we're just going to leave him on his side here for a sec. We didn't bring any of our gear to the patient's bedside, and there's this delay in care that ultimately was part of the problem. And same thing with the Earl Moore case. Had they just restrained that patient properly, the only thing that was different, they probably wouldn't be in that same situation, even with the same outcome. So good patient care really matters. Because once again, no one's asking specifically for you by name. They're asking for medical help, and I think we owe it to the public to provide the best patient care possible,
The
and to
way
not become complacent, because complacency can run rampant in EMS, and I think complacency is dangerous.
I've been able to handle similar situations myself as a paramedic is just that I always have the police officer ride with me in the back, and so that there's not someone following me, I'm not alone, and so that if something does go awry, there's a second person there, to help me and to even provide a legal restraint if it go, if it's that necessary.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's all about them
So,
playing ball with you too. You have to
well,
convince them to go.
and look, I mean, once again, in this day and age, I live in the Bay Area especially, law enforcement does not want to get involved in situations where they absolutely don't have to get involved in. And if the public is heightened scrutiny on EMS and fire responders, they certainly have increased scrutiny on law enforcement today. So many times it's, how do you balance these situations where EMS is being asked to do more and more and more that may have traditionally been law enforcement, but now law enforcement's taking the same approach of, is this person a patient or a suspect? Okay, they're a patient. Why am I as a state actor involved, as a state law enforcement officer involved in patient care? I get it. And I think that can place CMS providers in even more unique situations. So.
And these assaults and all of this this stuff that could potentially hurt providers is really common in the emergency room also. It's just that
Yeah.
they don't have cameras in there like we do, on the street for that kind of scrutiny. So I asked a doctor, what do you think if you were a doctor in the emergency room and you ordered the wrong medication and it killed a patient, do you think you'd be charged with murder? And the question went unanswered because, the reality is that there's checks and balances in the hospital that there's not in that
Yeah.
there's not with a sole provider alone.
And I think the answer to that question is who charged with murder was always, it depends, right? I mean, why, for example, was your ordering of a wrong medication, such a gross deviation to where you're disregarding a risk that you should have known of, or just so negligent that it was, shock the conscious so much? Well, then, yeah, I think you probably do stand a risk of criminal charges. And in some cases, rightfully so. Now I think people look at the Elijah McClain case and bring a new degree of concern. And I would really encourage folks, Paige Wolfberg worked at a phenomenal town hall session on that case. So I don't want to dive too far into detail on it. But I do think that when you look back at how some of the charging decisions were made around that case and just the timeline of events that led to charges being filed, the state attorney general filing charges at the state level instead of that being handled by the local DA, the medical director going back and changing the cause of death, I do think that that lends itself to an increased degree of suspicion about really what the motivation behind a lot of that was. So,
Meaning it could have been political. Is that what you're saying? Maybe.
well, I think it I think there was I think the timeline of events would certainly lend itself that there may have been more whether of a political lens to some of those charges. Now, obviously, look, a prosecutor was able to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that two paramedics were guilty. That's not a small task. So I'm certainly not saying that it ended up being baseless because clearly the jury result would lend itself to be otherwise. And I think that if you look at the facts that went into that charging decision, it definitely raises some questions, at least optically.
So you said you watched the video of the Illinois case also, right?
I did.
So how is it that the EMT is responsible? Or how in the world does the EMT who, helped the paramedic do the patient care that, that and then got up front and drive, like I would assume that it's her responsibility to manage the airway, her responsibility to make sure the patient's being monitored correctly. She's the one taking full control and responsibility by being in the back of the ambulance. How did he end up getting prosecuted?
So, yeah, I think the short answer, the, I think the short answer to that is, as an EMT, you have your own professional duty and you have your own professional obligations. And while you're not held to the standard of a care, the standard of care as a paramedic, you are held to the standard of care for an EMT. So is restraining a patient an EMT BLS skill? Absolutely. Should that EMT have known how to properly restrain that patient? Absolutely. Should that EMT have known how to properly manage a BLS airway? Absolutely. Once again. So you look at that video and you're going, wow, this EMT is here as a certified EMT working with a paramedic who knows or should have known that the actions that this paramedic was directing were likely to cause substantial bodily injury or death. And he just went with it. Now, and on one hand, I get it. She's the paramedic, he's the EMT, he's just kind of going with the flow. On the other hand, I do think that it means that when you're working with another provider, you don't give up the fact that you still have your own independent certification and in many cases your own independent licensure. And there's a duty to speak up to it, and there's a duty to speak up to a degree.
So the part of that that gives me hesitancy is just, I guess, how I've personally been enculturated, right? Because for my entire career, it has been very clear that the end of the road, the final word, the final say is always the
Paramedic.
paramedic. And the reason why is because the paramedic has knowledge that the EMT doesn't. And we all probably know that the EMT is trained at more of a responding to the problem instead of diagnosing, right? So you can't breathe well, help them breathe, versus the paramedic will be more about evaluating why they can't breathe. So there's like a
Hopefully.
different level of training to the point where sometimes the EMT actually doesn't know what's going on and the paramedic does, you know, like literally with the patient, you know, and what's happening in that moment. So considering that's been what's beat into all of us in the culture, I mean, this is this means that the EMT should have, you're saying, deeply questioned her and then call for another ambulance. And I just don't know how he could
You
prevent.
know, yeah, and I'm not necessarily saying that this was a deep questioning or that it needs to make a scene, but hey, you know, what do you think about restraining this person on her back? Hey, you know, what do you think about this? I mean, look, when you look at the way that nurses work with physicians all the time to suggest better care or to ask questions about, hey, that doesn't make sense, you know, especially in the ICU or an emergency department. Or if a physician may put in an order for something and you're looking at that patient going, is this really what they need right now? And there's a way to ask those questions and a way to bring up some of those issues in a way, in a manner which is still respectful, which doesn't make a scene, which isn't obstinate. But I think those skills need to be taught. Because just like in a hospital setting where when a nurse blindly follows physicians' orders or directives and that patient ends up harmed, that doesn't absolve that nurse of their professional responsibilities. Really, the same thing in EMS as well.
So I have a case to share with you that happened to me personally, and I, as a paramedic, I got to a patient who was in a violent episode, and when I walked into the room, he threw his spouse through a door, so it broke the door down as I was entering. So I entered to see this happen, and so me and my crew restrained him by holding him to the bed, and the wife said he's got a blood sugar problem. He's a diabetic. It's you know, that's what all it is. So we took his blood sugar. His blood sugar is like 30. And so the problem is that we have a very violent patient who is all alone with an EMS crew. So in this particular case, the police took a very, very long time to respond. So it was like over 30 minutes. And the fire crew that came to help, because we asked for help, refused to participate in the restraining of the patient. So it was like a reverse order kind of thing about what I'm talking about now. So the crew was like, the captain or whoever, the lieutenant, whoever on the fire crew was refusing to help us restrain him because he seemed oriented, because he seemed like he knew what he was talking about, because, you know, he could communicate normally. Meanwhile, he's been violent, done all this stuff, and has a blood sugar of 30. I'm hoping to get some glucagon in him or something to make this better. Yeah. The police are not coming. So out of this mess, what ended up happening was that the patient ended up not being restrained anymore because we couldn't hold it for 30 minutes with a whole crew just watching and contesting what we're doing. The patient ended up with a knife, you know, in a different floor of the house, and then just another calamity. So I guess I've been through situations where I have been questioned as a paramedic about my judgment by an EMT firefighter who walks into a situation and doesn't understand what I understand. They don't understand this is blood sugar. Yeah. And as a result, the patient ends up with a knife, you know, and I don't want to continue the story, but I'll just say that this is not good. So it's in my view, if the EMT would have just done what I said, help me restrain this person. He would have gotten the IV, the D50 and, you know, probably been better, but no, instead we have this whole other mess, and it's all because an EMT questioned my judgment. So so back to this other case, it's like there's good and bad that can come with those kinds of judgment calls by a lower level provider.
I'm hesitant to disagree with you. And I think, look, when somebody questions our judgment who may not have that same level of knowledge or training, I think the easy thing to do is to go, you know, I'm a paramedic on the flight. Look, I was, intubating a patient post drowning with an airway filled with a bunch of salt water in Northern California a number of years ago, and a volunteer firefighter grabs my shoulder and goes, "What are you doing? We don't intubate patients anymore. Just put in an LMA." And I think the easy response would be, "Excuse me, I'm holding a CMAC here. I'm the flight nurse. I'm the higher level of care. You're a volunteer firefighter. Why are you questioning my airway management decision?" That's what I wanted to say. I think fortunately, I pause and go, this is a drowning. I'm really concerned that this is a respiratory related arrest. I'd like to secure a definitive airway. That's why I'm intubating the patient. That took me 10 seconds, if even 5 seconds, to get that out. But it diffused him and it prevented potentially a situation where now when this patient arrests, inevitably again, this patient was already in arrest, we got pulses back and then he rearrested. Would have gone, "Oh my gosh, had they just listened to me and had they just put in the LMA, this wouldn't have happened." So I do think that as providers and professionals, we have to be able to handle brief in the moment criticism at least once and be able to rapidly, if nothing else, acknowledge, "I hear you and here's what we're doing." Yeah, and sometimes it's just "I hear you and here's what we're doing. I'm glad to explain when this situation is resolved." I hear what you're saying. This is what we're doing. I'm glad to explain this all to you, once we're out of this acute situation. I'm not going to take time in the middle of a crisis to explain my full clinical rationale to somebody, nor can I necessarily put that all together in real time. But I do think that it's important to acknowledge that, because imagine how that body cam footage would have looked for that EMT if that EMT was going, "Hey, I think we should really think about how we're restraining this patient." And certainly I suspect that his defense attorney, will assert some defense on the basis that he wasn't really the one in control of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So this reminds me of what ACLS has done with their changes over the years, because, back in the day when you took ACLS, it was, that one person was like solely responsible for every decision, and it's the lead provider. And now there's an open door policy for, everybody in the code room to ask questions, to give input. And I appreciate that. And what it means for folks that take ACLS is that it's a lot less stressful. I am familiar with grown men sitting in the hallway outside the door crying. It used to be really rough, but now having a more team approach, has lended itself to, hopefully less stress on just one person, and then also better outcomes, like you're saying, for folks to share with one another. Well, do you want to get into your article some?
Yeah, this is probably a bit of a soapbox topic for me, because I've seen this bite people in a clinical setting before as well. I can tell you more than a couple charts that I've looked at on cases that have been going towards litigation after the fact, where you go, "Wow, here the provider documented There's a GCS of 3, and here they documented that the patient was alert and oriented times 4. Which one is it? So conflicting information and documentation will only serve to undermine your credibility. And at the end of the day, if we find ourselves being deposed or being at trial, we want to be as credible as possible. And one way to undermine that credibility and undermine our trustworthiness and potentially to cause other individuals to question our veracity is when our documentation isn't consistent. Well, which one is it? Is it this or is it that? And I think interim PCRs can serve an important purpose of ensuring that care is transferred appropriately. And certainly I get it. In today's day and age where it can take 45 minutes to do a single chart. In some cases, I know in the helicopter, it was taking me an hour to do a chart. In some cases, for even a simple sing call, I worked some 911 calls last week. Even those simple charts were taking me probably 25, 30 minutes. Now, granted, I don't run as many calls as I used to, so some of that's probably on me. But the point of that is that it takes a while for providers to do a chart. So I don't think it's reasonable that the hospital is going to have that complete chart consistently. So I get the purpose of the interim chart. The hospital, the ER wants to know what happened. At the same point, when we document so much on that chart that we're locking ourselves into times of interventions, we're locking ourselves into do we have the right history down? We're locking ourselves into sometimes do we have the right vital signs down? And then we go back and we do a formal chart that really spells all this out. And that information doesn't match. And then we end up in many cases attaching that interim chart that was done closer to the actual patient care into the main chart. We create a situation where not only do we have a contradictory record, because your interim says one, and I say interim really with air quotes, but your interim says one, and your permanent chart says something else. But now I look at that interim chart and I go, well, Mr. Paramedic, you were doing this chart as the patient was right in front of you. Why wouldn't this chart be more accurate than the chart that you did several hours after the fact, when the call was done? So I think those really can be quite dangerous and quite problematic, and certainly in a hospital setting, I've seen records where that's been the case. So I would encourage providers and agencies to really be cautious with respect to their interim charts. And recognize that if you're doing them, they should really be simple notes that are just enough to hand over care,
Well, my
right?
thought
That are
was,
just simple enough to hand over care and ensure intervention. They should not be full gigantic PCRs in their own right. And certainly I've seen those and had to work with those extensively.
one of the things that has to line up is the when you're doing a CPR case and you have a lot of drugs that you're given, you got an epi every 3 to 5, you got your, and so forth. I think that when you're in the mix of things, like you're carrying someone down the stairs and it's time for another epi, or when you're moving, sometimes those exact times don't get put down, right? Or they're not always calculated perfectly. Because if I have a code team with me, then I can have a person that's set for documentation. But if not, I might just be counting how many epis I give. Like, so how much of a risk do providers put themselves in by, not being able to always show the exact time? And then, because what happens later if someone on video, shows you giving the drug 10 minutes later than you actually did? And then, could you be held liable for that? And, so just when it comes to PCRs, it's like, how does that
Great. I
seem?
mean, great question. So, times are, I think times are one thing. Certainly, more accurate is always better. And there's an element of appropriate care and appropriate efficiency. And that sometimes means that all times are approximate. I work with plenty of people who like to put all times approximate at the end of their narrative. Okay, great. I probably see less risk in time, in the time that's a minute or two off here and there, than I do in a situation to where your interim charts that your vitals are X at this time, but your permanent chart charts that vitals are Y at the same time. Your interim charts a GCS of 12, your permanent charts a GCS of 8, right? Your interim chart makes no mention, makes a mention of multiple medical problems. Your permanent chart doesn't. Those are, I think, the issues that really end up arising. Now, obviously, do I want any contradictory information? No. I'd like to minimize all contradictory information down to and including times. As for the accuracy of those times, always, certainly we need to be as honest, we need to be perfectly honest and truthful in our charts. But the reality of it is sometimes if you don't write down on that moment when you gave that medication, that may be an approximate time. And I think you can either document all times approximate, or if there was an issue, or if there was an issue after the fact, I think it could probably be relatively easily explained.
Well, thank you for sharing that because I had never thought to mention that in my report to write all times approximate because I think they almost always are approximate, sort of because you draw up a medicine and then maybe it's a minute later or a minute before or so great, great advice. So how about your other two articles? Do you have stuff you'd like to share from them?
So we so I feel like I feel like we talked a little bit about being reasonable and being kind to really start. And I'd reference folks back to that. We'd mentioned a little bit about criminal, civil, and kind of this bucket of administrative liability. I like to mention. I'll come back to, I think at the end of the day, most providers don't go to work going, my job is to do horrible patient care. I want to try and harm somebody today. And I hope that at the end of the day, I end up with a lawsuit or I end up arrested. But nevertheless, people end up there, right? Nevertheless, people end up there. And one of the things that we've seen with the Elijah McClain case and the Earl Moore Jr. case is really this notion of things that may have historically been considered civil issues. So not criminal, there's no intent. This is really more of a malpractice, potentially even a wrongful death lawsuit, now being treated criminally. And how do we adapt that and how and how do we and how do we effectively respond to that? And certainly if something is a crime, there's almost always, not always, but almost always, there's an associated civil tort that's associated with that. Assault is a crime, assault is also a civil tort. And congratulations if you commit, especially if you commit a crime, likely if you commit a civil tort as well, your local regulatory body will often have a well, often have a cause of action to discipline your license as well. So if you commit a crime, you run a risk of a civil tort. And you run a risk of action against your license. If you find yourself in a situation that's severe enough to generate civil liability, you also likely run a chance of an action again of having done something which could warrant an action against your license as well. So we really are kind of balancing multiple different buckets of liability at once, and in some cases they're really cascading, where criminal can cascade into civil, can cascade into administrative. It's also important to recognize that the burden of proofs are different. So criminal cases have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a very high standard, right? I think high 90s. No, not all doubt, but beyond a reasonable doubt. Civil cases only have to be proven to a preponderance of the evidence. So, think
51%.
51%, right? Think 51%. So, same fact pattern, same evidence. You may have enough evidence to get a civil conviction, but not be able to get a criminal conviction. The O.J. Simpson murder trial is a classic case of that, right? O.J. was acquitted criminally, but held civilly liable. And likewise, as to what burden of proof it takes against to take action against your license, that varies state by state, but it may actually be extraordinarily low, unless or until there's some form of appellate rights with that, where ultimately they would impose it. Ultimately, they would impose a burden of proof, whether that's preponderance of evidence or more likely than not clear and convincing evidence, which we think of as being somewhere in the 60s percent per se. And I think as providers are balancing all of these calculations, you can't practice EMS and be scared. And you can't look at every call as an opportunity to potentially get sued. Because if that's your mindset as you go out in the field, you're going to be so focused on trying to quote unquote protect yourself that you're not going to end up doing good medicine. And you're going to be practicing scared. And you're going to have a host of other issues because your main focus is on preventing myself from getting sued, not doing a good job of patient care, and really understanding your risk.
Okay, so we focus on our documentation, we're honest, we are reasonable and kind, and so a mistake happens, right? So if a
A
mistake
mistake
happens,
happens.
if it does happen, then how true is it that the quality assurance program that your company has will be able to protect you? Is that true? Like they say, like I've heard?
So there's a federal law which really attempts to protect most clinical reviews, and there are various state laws. In California, it's a little more nuanced and it's a little more complicated. The short answer is we hope so, and it really depends by the state, and it depends by that state's law on what is and isn't considered protected information. By and large, most of the laws that are designed to protect quality review and quality assurance are really established around hospital systems and established around protecting physicians and physician groups more than they are around having been designed to protect EMS providers. So probably as an aside, as an industry, really great area to advocate for good legislative change on, because I think our CQI should be able to be protected just the same as anyone else. Nevertheless, if there is an error, some information will be discoverable invariably. Your patient care report will be discoverable. What happened after the fact will likely be discoverable. What action your agency took against you, if they took employment action, that will likely also ultimately be discoverable. So while the actual CQI document of your chart, where your clinical manager and educator makes a bunch of comments, and your medical director talks to you, that might end up as protected. The whole host of other instances surrounding that won't be. And I
Because it's
think when
actual facts
mistakes
that happened. So it happened, right? That's why.
because it happened, and at the end, and really beyond that, if you're a patient, you have a right to know what your care was. You have a right to see your you have a right to see your medical record. And those facts would be material to an action if there was an incident. Incidents are going to happen regardless. Mistakes are going to happen. All of us, myself included, have made mistakes in patient care. And in some cases, those mistakes have probably amounted to negligence. It's going to happen, I think, if you are in this industry for long enough, but it's how you react to them. And I really do think that if you make a mistake, but there's a degree of honesty about it, 9 times out of 10, you find yourself in a much better spot. And certainly understanding your intentions going into it are important as well. It's much easier to go, oh my gosh, I gave the wrong dose of a medication and there was a complete harm. But my documentation reflects what happened. It reflects that as soon as I realized this, I took all these actions to appropriately stabilize the patient and provide appropriate patient care. I immediately notified the facility. I immediately informed the patient. I just want to let you know, family know, here's what happened. Here's what happened, and here's what we did. I think you end up in a better spot. Now, granted, I guarantee that there are plenty of lawyers out there who would take the
Confirm.
attitude who would take the attitude of say nothing, don't tell the family anything, just keep your documentation to scant, and you're probably in a better spot when you get sued. And frankly, from that standpoint, probably right. I'd like to try and prevent myself from being named in an action to begin with,
Right.
and would almost rather take more risk on the front end of going, how do we control this up front so I don't have to control this on the back end?
Okay, so last question. Here's the big one. Is this EMS liability insurance, medical malpractice insurance, is it worth it? I mean, is this something that we maybe should consider? Is it gonna like help us?
So from a civil standpoint and an action license standpoint, I carry insurance, and I don't think it's a bad idea at all. Highly recommend it. I think the price is reasonable. You cannot insure against criminal acts,
Right.
right? So you cannot insure against criminal acts, and you cannot insure against intentional torts by and large. So just because I have, so just because I carry malpractice insurance doesn't mean that I can walk up to a patient and punch them, for example.
Oh,
That's
yeah.
not going to be covered by insurance, either criminally or for the civil tort of battery.
Well, that makes sense. So before we go, do you have anything for the last word about what we were
No,
saying?
you know, I would encourage folks, do patient care, do good patient care. Focus on showing up every day, like it's day one. You never know when you're going to have to dig way back into your brain and into your tool bag to pull a rabbit out of the hat, and when your ability to pull that rabbit out of the hat, really may make a difference in someone else's life. So, I think be ready to do that every shift. Be reasonable. Be kind. Do good patient care, and stay safe.
I feel like my dad's patting me on the back before I walk out for school. We're going to do great. Thank you so much for your advice.
Thanks.
John Ray Hassan, appreciate you today.
All right, take care. Thanks, Brim.
I want to also invite you to check out my latest book I co-authored with Four Arrows, who has two doctorates and is an expert on indigenous scholarship and hypnosis. So I just want to invite you to check it out because we introduce a method for communicating with patients on the scene of an emergency that takes advantage of some of the properties found in hypnosis. This book works to change the way we approach and interact with any kind of emergency patient in acute distress because it's going to help you be a better practitioner and use communication as a healing tool. Right now, there's just not a lot of training in how to talk to your patient. And if you've been stuck with a patient for any period of time and you need to have a conversation, it's awesome to be able to have a healing conversation. This book is called Hypnotic Communication in Emergency Medical Settings for Life-Saving and Therapeutic Outcomes. You can follow the link below to find it, or you can find it literally almost anywhere you type in the name or my name. I had a friend that mailed me a book and wanted an autograph. Don't mail me a bunch of books. Just let me know that you want an autograph for the book, and I'll be happy to send you over a sticker. I have some stickers made that are pretty awesome that I'll send you that you could put in the cover.
Hi, I'm Will Chaplot from the International Pre-Hospital Medicine Institute. You might know about us because of the literature reviews that we post every month free for your review on our website at iphmi.com and also published through GEMS Online Magazine every month. We've been doing them for 5 years, so now we've accumulated over 240 literature reviews over the past 5 years. And we've gotten feedback from our audience that said they'd like to have these things as desk references so they'd had a rapid reference. Well, we've done it. And there are now five volumes of these books, one for each year that we've been publishing them. This is the latest version, volume five. And as I said, in each of these, there's at least 48 literature reviews. They're all cataloged in the beginning of the book, so you can see what the topic area is, what pages those reviews are on, and how you can find them quickly. And again, these are a great reference whether you're putting a lecture together, working on a paper, studying, whatever it is. This gives you the depth of field of the science that dictates what we do in the field or what we should be doing in the field or why we've changed the way we do things in the field. In any event, as with all of our publications, we've priced these because we want you to be able to have this book. It's only $4.99 in the copy, the hard copy here, and they're all five of them are available at that price, but you can also get them as ebooks, and they're available as ebooks from Amazon, from Apple, from Barnes & Noble, wherever you get your ebooks for the price of $2.99. So again, we don't do this with an aim towards getting wealthy. We do these because we want you guys to be able to have these materials, relevant information, affordable information, and an access so you can get to it. So, you want the hard copies? Go on Amazon, $4.99. Go to your ebook store and you get it for $2.99. If you're in the business, this is the kind of material you want to have around to settle those firehouse arguments or to help you put your materials together. Thanks again. See you all soon. Thanks.
The other thing before we close that I want to share is that I'm doing a research project related to first responders who live in the United States, and I could really use your help if you don't mind being interviewed over a video call. So go to my website, fill out the form that's at professorbram.com, professorbram.com. And thank you again for listening. I look forward to sharing more insights with you in this next episode. If you enjoy EMS research, please tell your friends, like, share, and subscribe to help others get the message. And then stay tuned for the credits at the end so you can see the research articles that we talked about in today's episode.